Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, sponsored by Microsoft Federal. Now your host, Federal News Radio DoD reporter, Jared Serbu.
Good afternoon. 5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for listening to another edition of On DoD. We're going to spend the hour today on the Army Reserve, a piece of the uniformed military that's at a particular time of transition. Not just the transition from wartime to peacetime and to leaner budget times that the rest of the military is going through right now, but they're also in the middle of a change at the top. Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz has just retired, handing over the title of Commanding General of Army Reserve Command to a new leader, Lieutenant General Jeffrey Talley, during a June 9th ceremony at Fort Bragg. Shortly before that, though, General Stoltz sat down with me and three other reporters for about an hour at the Pentagon. We're going to bring you most of that conversation during the course of this hour. He started by telling us about the new personalized license plates he's hoping to get.
I guess of significance, I just went down to Florida, where I've got a home that I'll be retiring to in July. And in this position as the Chief of the Army Reserve, I'm known as the car. So I just applied for a personalized license plate for my car that says used car. So I'm preparing for the future. I guess the way I've kind of looked at things here, looking back, the challenge I had coming into this job was transforming the Army Reserve from a strategic, you know, under-trained, under-equipped, undermanned force by design, not by default, but by design, to an operational force, because it was obvious that we were going to be in an extended conflict and the Army could not do the mission without the use of the Army Reserve because of the capabilities resident in our force. And the challenge I had was, how do you transform where resources are pretty much unconstrained? We've got OCO dollars back then, supplemental, when we were first starting out. It's time that's the challenge. We need it done today, and it takes time to transform, but we need the force on the battlefield today. I think my successor, Jeff Talley, who's coming in behind me, his challenge is going to be, how do you maintain that operational force you've created when time is not going to be a factor, because we're drawing down out of Iraq already and will be in Afghanistan? It's going to be resources that are going to be the factor, because our Army is still going to depend on the Army Reserve for vital capabilities in the future. And we're not going to have time, should something happen in other parts of the world, to take a strategic force and get it into an operational, because the capabilities aren't resident in the proper capacity in the active force. And we're getting ready to come down in strength in the active force. The Army Reserve is an indispensable force for our nation, because we've created an army, 1.1 million with the active guard and reserve. But as we grew the army in the active force, we grew combat brigades, we grew combat aviation, we grew cyber capability, those kind of capabilities. We continued to push the what we call the enablers, the combat support, service support, into the Guard and Reserve. So today you've got a force with about 85% of the transportation capability in the Guard and Reserve, about 75% of the engineering capability in the Guard and Reserve, 85% of the civil affairs capability in the Reserve, 70% of the medical capability in the Guard and Reserve. And so that's why I say it's an indispensable force now, is we've created the Army that way. And to be perfectly honest, it makes sense. It's very cost effective. The best example I can use is medical. If we create a, and that, by the way, that's how the Army Reserve started back in 1908 as a medical reserve. But if you take people who do that skill every day in their civilian job, as a doctor, as a nurse, as an X-ray technologist or whatever, it's very easy to transfer them onto the battlefield without worrying about, can they do their mission? You got to train them how to stay alive. you know, how do you perform medicine in Afghanistan versus in Fairfax, Virginia? It's a little different environment, but practice of medicine is the same. And so it makes sense to say we want to have certain capabilities that we can put into the reserve component that they can transfer that skill immediately onto the battlefield without having to worry about getting them trained. If I've got a guy that's driving a truck for Schneider Trucking, he can probably drive a truck in Iraq or Afghanistan. I just got to teach him how to drive it on that environment. An engineer doing the same thing. He can do engineering on the battlefield that he does in his civilian skill. You can't do the same with an artilleryman. He doesn't fire too many rounds in his civilian job, at least I hope he's not. So we got to train him up to standard. For my Apache battalions, my attack helicopters, same thing. It takes a lot to get them up to the standard we need them at before we put them into battle because of its combat skills required. So it makes a lot of sense to put a lot of the what we call enablers in the reserve because it's very cost effective and you can maintain those skill sets. And so I think as we move forward, or my successor moves forward, that's where we'll focus, I think, with the Army Reserve is what are the capabilities that this nation and our Army needs that we can provide and we can provide with confidence that we can maintain them in a pretty high level of readiness so they can respond whenever needed. So I feel good about where we are. We got a lot of great soldiers. You know, the best thing I've had in the 6 years I've been in this job is the opportunity just to get out and see great heroes. And by heroes, I'm not talking about necessarily somebody that's, you know, jumping on a grenade in the battlefield or anything. It's heroes that are leaving their families, leaving their civilian jobs, leaving their homes to go to Iraq, Afghanistan, or whatever. And they don't have to. They volunteered. And they stand there and look you in the eye and take an oath of reenlistment while you're there with them in Afghanistan to stick with you. I mean, it's amazing what we've created in terms of the reserve component of a volunteer army. We're the envy of the rest of the world. As I've traveled the world the last several years, it doesn't matter if I'm in Uganda or Kenya or if I'm in Japan or Korea, the heads of their military say, how did you do that? How do you get people to volunteer with such high skills to go and do what they're doing for you?
Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz speaking to us at the Pentagon just before he retired after 6 years as Chief of the Army Reserve. We'll have much more from him in the hour ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. This week, we're hearing from the outgoing Chief of the Army Reserve. Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz is on his way to retirement in Florida. He officially turned over the reins to Lieutenant General Jeffrey Talley in a change of command ceremony on June 9th at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Before leaving, though, he sat down with me and a few other reporters at the Pentagon to talk about his six-year tenure leading the force and take some questions and answers about the future. We start out this segment with a question about some new authorities the Army Reserve got in last year's defense authorization bill, giving them the ability to respond to domestic natural disasters for the first time.
You know, for some time, the law said in incidents of natural disasters, the only time you could access your Title 10 reserve, Air Force, Navy, Marine, or Army, was in instances with weapons of mass destruction. We finally got the law changed because we've got a lot of great soldiers that are living in the same proximity. And you know, in the first response, it's always going to be civil authorities responding first. And then next, it's going to be the governor calling out his National Guard. And we're not trying to replace any of that. It's just that when the governor of the state or wherever it's occurring, the region, says, hey, I need federal help, in the past, the only answer was, we'll send the active army. And in a lot of cases, there was reserve component soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines that were close at hand with the capabilities needed but didn't have the authority to act. This new legislation says now we can use the Title 10 reserve. So both Army North and Northcom with General Jacoby, they're relooking how do they define their federal response plan to take advantage of the capabilities we have. I just mentioned, you know, you look at it and say, in a natural disaster, what are two critical things I probably need? Well, I need transportation to get supplies in and get people out, and I need medical. And I just said 85% of that is in the Guard and Reserve and 70% of the medical. But we weren't tapping into that in the past in the large numbers that we had available. So this new authority gives us the authority to do that. I used a good example with my good friend, Congressman Bill Young, down in Florida. He's been a strong supporter of ours and a personal friend of mine for a number of years. And he helped us get the medevac unit established in Clearwater, Florida, which is one of the premier medevac units now in the Army. They've been deployed a number of times, and I just visited them in Afghanistan a couple of months ago. But I said, you know, the next Hurricane Andrew that hits Florida, unless we get the law changed, sir, you can't use them. And I said, that doesn't make sense that we've invested in those soldiers and their residents of Florida. They want to respond and help their fellow Floridians in that situation, as does the engineer battalion in Miami, as does the hospital units in Miami, Tampa, and Jacksonville, as do the MPs in Ocala, in Tampa, in Fort Lauderdale. But unless we get the law changed, they're not going to be available. And so Congress did the right thing. And it makes a lot of sense now to say, one, let's take advantage of the capability. But also, you know, if I'm a resident of Florida and a hurricane's hit and I'm without power and I'm needing debris cleared and I'm driving by a motor pool that's got a bulldozer and some dump trucks and everything, I don't want to hear about Title 32 versus Title 10 and the law, whatever. I just say, you know, my tax dollars paid for that. Why aren't they helping me? Well, now we're going to be able to do that. It's the good thing to do. We've had a couple of, in fact, they just recently had a rock drill out at San Antonio with Army North, where we played the hurricane scenario. And we played two hurricanes hitting the U.S. almost simultaneously. So it would require a federal response. And that was part of what we were working our way through is, okay, how does the, you know, the governor and the adjutant general within the state go through the process of asking for federal help, and how does Army North and Northcom identify what capabilities are close by that they could use, and then how do we go through alerting those forces to get ready to go down to help this, you know, natural disaster, in this case, the hurricane response. And then, as always, you know, who cuts the orders to put them on active duty and who provides the funding and all those kind of things that we're still working our way through. But the good news is everybody's on board, from the governors to the adjutant generals to Army North, Northcom, to say this is going to be a good thing. We just got to make sure we've got the procedures and the processes worked out. Let's don't wait till a hurricane hits to find out how do we do it.
This is on DOD on Federal News Radio. That's Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz during a recent roundtable with me and a few other reporters just before retirement as Chief of the Army Reserve. I'm Jared Serbu. Next up, I asked him to clarify some of the comments he made in the first segment of the hour you heard with regard to how the Army Reserve is going to absorb some of the service members who are coming out of the active Army as it reduces its size. I asked him whether the people the reserve takes in are going to be weighted toward the enabling capabilities, as he called them, like medical skills he talked about earlier, rather than combat specialties.
Well, I think it'll be potentially both. Obviously, you know, what I've said for some time, we've described it in different terms. One is a continuum of service. One is a soldier for life mentality. But the idea of, when you join the military, you're going to go back and forth between active status, reserve status, maybe inactive status. And how do we take advantage of that to leverage the investment we've already spent? So as we draw down the force in the active side, one of the things I'm looking at is, yeah, we have an opportunity. We're short NCOs right now, our mid-grade non-commissioned officers. And we're short in our mid-grade officers, our captains and majors. I think there's going to be a number of those that will be leaving the active army by choice in some cases, just saying, hey, it's time for me to go and I'd like to try something else. And so what I want to be able to do is put some resources on the installations. And it's really not necessarily a recruiter. You can call them that. But I tell them they need to be counselors. They need to be able to sit down and say, okay, Jared, you're deciding to leave the active army. First, the mentality has got to be you're not getting out, you're going to transition. Because you really are going to transition. Whether you know it or not, you're going to go into the IRR, Individual Ready Reserve, and whatever. So you're still going to have an obligation. So you're going to be transitioning. I want somebody to sit down and be able to talk to you about what do you want to do? What's your goal in life? What's your objective? Do you have a career that you're looking at? Because you may be an infantry guy, but you may say, you know, I really want to work in law enforcement. And we might say, then we could use you because we have military policemen. So I don't want to turn away a combat arms guy just because he doesn't have the MOS. At the same time, if you are already a 31 Bravo MP and you're a staff sergeant and you've got a great record, you've met all the standards and whatever, then we ought to be locking in on you and saying, we really need Jared. We need him in our force. But I shouldn't be talking to you about what unit I'm going to put you in until I talk to you about where you're going to live. Part of my responsibility ought to be then, let me help you find a job in law enforcement if that's what you want to do through our employer program that we've got had for the last 4 years. And we've got a lot of connections with the National Sheriff's Association, law enforcement agencies around the country. So if you say, okay, yeah, I'd like to come back to the Northern Virginia area. All right, Kathy Lanier and I signed an agreement several years ago where I can work directly with the D.C. police to take soldiers coming out of the active army or in the Army Reserve and help put them into jobs in D.C. We can do that. And I've got MP units at Fort Meade, Maryland that I can get you into, too. So now let's put a plan together. But I also need to talk to you about, do you understand what you've already invested? Let's say you've got 6 years of active duty. You've already got 6 years toward earning a retirement that, yeah, at this point in your life, you may not be concerned about a retirement, but let me tell you what that's going to mean to you later on. And here's the additional income or the medical benefits or all the other stuff. And that's where that counselor comes in. It's not just a recruiter trying to sell you on the Army Reserve. He's trying to sell you on your future and civilian employment, financial, all those kind of things, so that you come in with a positive attitude saying, this is a good move for me and my family. If we can pull that together, one, for every soldier I bring from the active service already qualified, that's one less recruiting bonus, that's one less training seat, that's one already qualified soldier that immediately steps in and brings my readiness up. Huge benefit. At the same time, I'm overstrength in skill level one, the junior enlisted soldiers right now. What we ought to be thinking about is I've got these excess skill level ones right now, overstrength. That's one less recruit to pay for recruiting onto the active army because I've already paid for them. I've already trained them. And it ought to be a two-way street where you're bringing the junior enlisted over to this side to help because you're always going to have to recruit young soldiers to keep it going. At the same time, I'm bringing some of the mid-grades over. So there's this cycle of talent that we're really treating it as one force. And it is that soldier for life of you're not getting out. You're just transitioning. You're going to transition from active to reserve while this guy over here is transitioning from reserve to active. And at some point you may come in and say, hey, I just need a break. Okay, we're going to transition to inactive right now so that you can get your life together, new career, new family, whatever you're doing. But the understanding is our plan is to bring you back either into the active reserve or active army at some point.
And as far as that recruiting or counseling program that you want to get going, I mean, do you feel like you have a partnership with the active army so that they can push departing soldiers toward you rather than, you know, you having to pull them in?
I don't. In the past, I wouldn't say that's been the case because the active army, just like us, had been trying to hold on to everybody we could to maintain our end strengths and with the op tempo we were doing. And so I would say, yeah, the focus of the active army was retention, not transition. With the drawdown, I am seeing a shift to where their focus is on how do we transition and keep some of this talent that we've invested in, that we've got now. And so I think, at least from my dealings with the G1, General Bostic, with others, they're on board with this makes sense for all of us. One, it saves talent that we desperately need to save. And number two, it saves money. So we don't pay for additional soldiers and training that we already have in our force.
Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz, the outgoing chief of the Army Reserve and the longest serving chief of the Army Reserve ever. We'll continue with more of his recent conversation with me and a few other reporters when we return with On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Welcome back to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. As we continue our focus on the Army Reserve this hour, I'm Jared Serbu, and this is Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz on his last day in office as the Chief of the Army Reserve during a change of command ceremony at Fort Bragg on June 9th. He told the crowd it's been the best 6 years of his life.
And as I remind Congress and others every chance I get, they don't have to be there. And you've heard me say this, until you've been with me, and many of you have, on Christmas Day in Iraq or Afghanistan with a group of soldiers who are missing their families, missing a special time that they'll never recapture, getting ready to go out on a mission, and they're going to risk their lives. They may be called upon to make the ultimate sacrifice, but before they leave the FOB, they raise their hand and do an oath of reenlistment. It's unbelievable. That's the profession of arms. That's what's special that we're all part of. So it's been an honor for me just to serve alongside those great men and women. So I'm not leaving sad. I'm smiling. It's been a great run. And to all of you here, thanks for what you've done for me, for Laura. But more importantly, thanks for what you're doing for our soldiers and their families every day. God bless this nation, and God bless our great soldiers. And God bless all of you. It's been an honor to serve with you.
Again, Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz at the change of command ceremony for the Chief of the Army Reserve. He turned over command to Lieutenant General Jeffrey Talley at that June 9th ceremony. Before that, though, he sat down with me and three other reporters at the Pentagon to talk about the future of the Reserve. We're going to continue to listen back through that roundtable now. In this excerpt, he's asked about sequestration and how it would impact the Reserve and what needs to be done to keep reservists engaged once they're no longer deploying to Afghanistan.
One of the things I think, looking to the future with sequestration, if that occurs, it's going to put more emphasis on the relevance of the reserve component, because obviously anytime our budgets are reduced, what we have to say is how do we provide the forces necessary to defend our nation for our national security, and how do we do it within the budget constraints we've got? And so if that were to occur, I think, yeah, it's going to force us all to say just what I've said earlier. What are the capabilities that we're going to have to rely on being in the reserve? And of those capabilities, where's the best fit? Because that's going to be the Army we can afford. For me personally, looking at the reserve itself, and you brought up a good point. When I have gotten around over the past several years and talked to soldiers, and I ask them, what do you need? What do you want? There's usually about three key things that come through every time. One is predictability. Give me some predictability because I've got another life. I've got a job in my civilian life. I've got a family, whatever. And that's that orphogen, that fourth generation cycle. We've said, okay, we're working to a five-year cycle, so you would be in the available window once every 5 years for utilization. The rest of the time, you would be training. Second thing they say is, don't waste my time. If you're going to bring me in for training, if you're going to bring me in for drill or whatever, make it meaningful. And then the third one is, use me. I didn't sign up just to be a weekend warrior, that old strategic reserve. And so part of the challenge we're going to have in the future is where the soldier says, don't waste my time. And we're going to have, you know, constrained resources. I think we've got to really leverage a lot of the simulation capabilities we now have for training purposes. We've got convoy trainers. We've got aviation trainers. We've got everything from watercraft trainers to the weapon system trainers, where you can put a person in a drill hall in the same environment they've been in Afghanistan, virtually walking through a village and trying to identify if there's a threat and respond. Those are the kind of scenarios I think we've got to use in the future, of leveraging the simulation capabilities out there to make it meaningful training. And then secondly, when I do bring them in for their annual training events, what we have done is we've focused on three platforms: Fort Hunter Liggett in California, Fort McCoy in Wisconsin, and Fort Dix in New Jersey. So I've got a West Coast, East Coast, Middle America. And what I've said is those have to become, for lack of a better term, a center of excellence. In other words, when the soldiers go there for their annual training, we have everything in terms of modern equipment, simulation systems, field training environments, everything that the soldier walks away from there at the end says, wow, this was very, very worthwhile. It put me right back into this, you know, the feeling I was had when I was in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is good training. I've sharpened my skills. I've gotten that edge back. And then the last thing is where we said, use me. Another specific law in there that was changed is the ability to use your Title 10 reserve for unnamed contingencies. That's the overseas contingencies. We've done a lot of that in the past. The theater engagement, security cooperation, our best example I use, our medical forces. We have them in Asia. We have them in Central America, South America, places like that. They go down for these medical readiness exercises and provide medical care to the local civilians in El Salvador, Guatemala. We had them in Vietnam and Cambodia in the past couple of years. But we use our annual training authorities for that. So that's 21 to 29 days. And by the time they get down and get in place, they probably have about 14 usable days before they have to pack up and come back. With this new authority, now we can send them down for much longer periods of time. And so what I want to be able to do is say, okay, in that available year, once every 5 years, be prepared, and we'll tell you in advance so you got predictability. But if you're a hospital unit, you may go to Guatemala, Panama, El Salvador, Colombia, someplace like that, and spend 3 months, not 3 weeks, and really be effective and efficient at what you're doing. And then we may replace you with another unit that's in that available year so that the U.S. Army South Commander and Southern Southcom Commander now can really develop an engagement strategy across their entire area of responsibility and say, hey, I can expand what I'm doing with the engineers or what I'm doing with the medical or even with some of the training resources we've got. So that's kind of what I'm saying is we got to figure out a way to use them effectively. It doesn't have to be for a 12-month deployment. Give them predictability and then don't waste their time. You know, my daughter just graduated from pharmacy school at the University of Florida. And one of the things I saw while she was in pharmacy school versus her undergrad is they didn't go to campus for any of the lectures. All the lectures were on the computer. And it was your responsibility as a student to watch the lectures. And you could watch them over and over if you couldn't figure out what the professor was saying. You go to the campus for the exams and the labs. And I think that's something we got to look at in the reserve. How do we decentralize some of the training we're doing so that that soldier doesn't necessarily get in a car and drive to the reserve center on a weekend drill? Maybe we send it to him if it's some type of lecture-type material, other types of mandatory training, and use the devices we've got today to save, one, money, but also so that that soldier says, you know, I didn't waste my time driving to the reserve center this weekend and sitting in a classroom listening to somebody give me mandatory training on Geneva Hague Convention, CIDA, sexual harassment, all these mandatory courses. They sent them to me, and during the month, I was able to go on in the evenings and complete all the training required. And, oh, by the way, I got compensated for a weekend drill. That's what they're looking for.
That's Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz on Federal News Radio, the recently retired chief of the Army Reserve, sitting down with a few reporters, including myself, just before he took off the uniform for the last time. One more question dealing with sequestration and whether the reserves are in a better position to absorb the blow of that across-the-board budget cut than are the rest of the military services.
The way I look at it, I look at it from a more of a capabilities. What are the capabilities the Army has to have? And if sequestration occurs, what are the capabilities they're going to be dependent upon the reserve for, and even more than they have in the past? Here's the challenge. You know, when you're talking about taking cuts in the reserve component to save dollars, because it's a, for lack of a better term, a part-time soldier, our costs, you know, you're talking you mentioned the number of $500 billion budget, of which I'm about $7 billion. So I'm a very small piece of that budget. So to take significant cuts in the reserve to generate the dollars you need, you're going to have to cut significant force structure. Almost 3 or 4 to 1 in terms of versus active. And when you're talking about already having 70% of the medical structure that you've got to have in the reserve, or 85% of the transportation or others, what are you going to cut that you're going to say we don't have to have anymore? And at what number? So, and I'm not trying to paint a bleak picture. I think the challenge we're going to have is, how can we not afford to have the reserve even more so in the future than in the past if sequestration occurs, because we can't generate the dollars needed out of the reserve. It's going to have to come out of the active in a lot of cases. I mean, we're going to have to take across the board, all of us will have to take some cuts. But I think the force structure for the reserve is not the answer. It's probably going to be in some of the equipping and some of those types of areas where we can generate some dollars. But force structure is not going to give you a whole lot of dollars in payback versus the capability you're going to lose.
Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz, the outgoing chief of the Army Reserve and the longest serving chief of the Army Reserve ever. One more segment on the Army Reserve when we return on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. One more segment with Jack Stoltz, who just retired from the Army Reserve as the chief of the Army Reserve. Before he left, he sat down with me and a few other reporters at the Pentagon to talk about what's ahead after his six-year tenure. In this excerpt from that roundtable, he talks about the change he's seen in his time as a soldier, who joins the Reserve now compared to three decades ago.
I came in the Army in 1974, and we were just coming out of Vietnam and going to a volunteer army. And the reason people joined the reserve back then, in a lot of cases, was to avoid the draft. Not because they loved the military necessarily. I mean, you did have some, but a lot of people during that era were getting into the reserve components as a way of avoiding the draft so that they can continue their education or their civilian jobs or whatever. So it's not a bad thing. It's just that was it. You fast forward to where we are today, and as I mentioned earlier, it's an all-volunteer force. The quality of the force that we have today, better educated than I've ever seen them, but more importantly, better motivated. You know, if you think about the soldier that joins the Army Reserve today while we're at war, or has been in the last, you know, 8 or 10 years, they knew what they were getting into. And it wasn't the unemployed, looking for a job, those kind of things. It was, I want to serve my country. I want to do something meaningful. I want to fulfill a desire I've got. And I've told a number of stories of you're on the battlefield with a soldier and you say, so where did you get your degree? And he goes, grad or undergrad? Okay, grad. Well, I got my PhD at MIT. And it's a lieutenant. And you're saying, what are you doing here? And it's like, well, sir, I felt like I needed to serve my country, and so I joined. You know, I've told the story of, I retired from Procter & Gamble. And I was in Afghanistan with a civil affairs unit, and a sergeant came up to me and said, "Hey, sir, I want to get my picture with you." I said, "Okay." He says, "Well, I work for Procter & Gamble." And I said, "Well, I retired." And he says, "Yeah, I know, but I want to get my picture. I'm going to send it back to Cincinnati." I said, "Okay, what do you do for P&G? He says, "Oh, I'm a scientist." This is a sergeant. And he's like, "What did you do for P&G?" And I said, "Don't worry about it. It wasn't anything close to what you're doing." But it's the talent that we've got in our force today, and it's the motivation they're coming in with. You know, they're joining to be part of something. It really does make you feel good. And I think it's part of that combat multiplier, that when you have a reserve force on the battlefield, you may have a guy who's might be an MP, but he may also be a high school principal, or he might be a bank vice president, or he, you know, he's got this talent that you never counted on having that you can leverage on the battlefield. If we don't keep them engaged, that's what the soldiers tell me is, "Hey, I want it. Don't waste my time. Make it meaningful, and then use me." And I think we have a wealth of opportunities. You know, the area that I've seen us not being able to meet in the past has been a lot of this theater engagement, security cooperation, but just because everything was focused on Iraq and Afghanistan. I think we now have an opportunity to shift that focus and say, how do we leverage this talent we have in the reserve that is very cost effective?
Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz, outgoing Chief of the Army Reserve. You're listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio. Continuing our personnel theme, he told us about how different parts of the force will be in different readiness levels going forward, depending on their role.
You're going to have a certain amount of the force capability that almost has to be ready all the time. High demand, low density type stuff. Some of our port opening type capability, if we have to go into wherever, we're going to have that right now. Then there's going to be, I think, in the center, much of this more rotational capability of 5 year, 6 year, whatever, and say, okay, that kind of capability we need to have trained and ready, and we can use it in part of the engagement strategy, whatever. And then I think, yeah, you're going to have a certain group down here that certain types of units that we're going to say probably doesn't have to be ready to go overnight or in the first X number of days, and so we can have them at a lower op tempo and lower, and I think that's good. Because you're going to have soldiers who want to go up and down that continuum also. You're going to have a soldier who's going to come in and says, you know, I just got a promotion in my job. I really need to get into a more stable unit. At the same time, you're going to have a soldier down here in that the more sustained or strategic level that says, hey, you know, I'm at the point in my career, I want to get up here. I want to go do something. So put me in one of these units up here. We need the ability to let people go up and down like that. You know, I don't know. Hard to say. For my force, it might be, and I'll just throw it out here because, you know, some of our chemical units, you know, that aren't part of the rotational force, we're not using them in Iraq or Afghanistan, places like that. We did initially when we were concerned, and then we brought them home. So maybe we say, okay, you guys just stay down here, stay trained, ready, and current, but you don't have to be ready to go, and you're not going to be rotating every 5 years. There could be, you know, some of our logistics units that we might put into that, you know, level down there, some of our water purification or things like that, that you say, hey, be ready to go more of a homeland response if you needed to, and so I don't have to have you combat ready, but I, you know, you're trained in your technical skills, and I think some of those, and it could be in some cases where you've got certain amount of those units up in the rotational side and certain ones down here, and you might at some point choose to trade them out based on maybe you're reconfiguring your force, restructuring, doing some things, and say, okay, we're going to bring you guys down here, take you out of the rotational so that we can change your mission set, change your equipment sets, do things like that while we'll bring these guys up here and put them in the rotation.
Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz speaking to us at the Pentagon just before he retired after 6 years as Chief of the Army Reserve. That happened June 9th in a change of command ceremony at Fort Bragg. He just handed over command of the reserve to Lieutenant General Jeffrey Talley, who we're expecting as a future guest on this program. Stay tuned for that. And thanks for listening to On DoD this week. As always, we're at federalnewsradio.com, where you'll find all of our past programs. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu, sponsored by Microsoft Federal. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.